Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
All right, welcome to the latest edition of Hear That Podcast Growl, and Paul Diener Jr. and Jay Morrison of The Athletic are excited to be with you. I don't know, should I speak for you, Jay? Are you excited or are you not?
I am excited. It's sunny. It's March. Feels like we're progressing closer, not just to the season, but maybe to more of a sense of normalcy. I don't know. Just we got kind of an optimistic outlook this week.
Yeah, it's because you got that shot.
That is true. I'm halfway vaccinated. Halfway. Yeah. Back to sitting at the bar.
Yeah, it's really what it's about for you, isn't it?
It is.
It's like, at the bottom line, it's just comfort at the bar. That's all. That's all this is about for you. Jay just needs to have that good cold bar Jaeger at his arm's reach.
Yes, because I don't mind sitting at the bar if they've got partitions up and no one can sit next to you. But you always worry about that person that comes in and sits next to you. You have no idea where they've been, who they've been around. That's what makes it so dicey.
Yeah, well, look at you getting your vax. Congratulations, and no wonder you're so optimistic, feeling good. Yeah, I'm optimistic about us being able to talk about concrete items and not speculative items sometime in the near future, because I just don't know how many more speculative 10 things that they might do here in 2 weeks. It's just, it's really, we've been doing this, you know, and those of us that cover teams that have been out of it for a while at the end of the season have been doing this for even longer. It's just felt like the longest offseason ever, waiting to get to the new league year. We're getting closer. We have some news on that. We'll talk a little bit about some of the latest string of cap casualties. We'll talk a little bit about J.J. Watt ending up in Arizona, and there is a Bengals side to that a little bit. Jay, of course, will have some stats there. I'll talk a little bit about free agent spending, which has kind of come up as we continue to assess what they will do, how much they will spend, how much they should. A few other notes that we'll get to. But a lot of today, we're going to talk a little bit about a story that I posted today, which was kind of a deep look at the Bengals' social media and marketing campaign and everything that's kind of happened behind it, including, you know, sort of the person who has become at the head of it, and that is Elizabeth Blackburn, who is the daughter of Troy and Katie Blackburn and granddaughter of Mike Brown, and has joined the team in January, basically, of last year, and is director of strategy and engagement, and essentially took on reconnecting with fans and seeing that as a area where she felt she could come in and help. She's 28 years old. She had been, you know, she worked in San Francisco, she worked in New York. She's had a quick stint in the league office even, but she's in, you know, business management analytics. She's, you know, double major from Dartmouth, super intelligent, high energy, type person. There's a lot to all of this, more so than maybe meets the eye of, oh, memes, right? Like, there's a lot of things that happen here. So I want to kind of dive into it, and you're going to hear from Elizabeth Blackburn here on the show. I talked with her last week, for this story, along with Seth Tanner, who's their new director of content, who's kind of was also at the spearhead of the social media stuff. And people have noticed that a lot. And it's been a story that's been on my radar for a long time, and I'm happy to finally be able to do it. So we're going to kind of dive into that, and you'll hear from Elizabeth on some other topics that I didn't write about as well on today's pod. So I'm excited to do that. Jay, you listened to the interview in full and some of the portions that we'll hear here today. What was just kind of an initial takeaway from you? I've been in it. My brain's kind of been deep in it for a few days now. So maybe I'm not the right person to even ask about it anymore. I'm curious what your thoughts were, kind of going through some of that stuff.
Well, first of all, my favorite tweet of the week last week was when someone said it's going to be a race to see which podcast gets Elizabeth on first. And you sent out the winking cat because you knew you had already got her. Yeah. So yeah, that was great. I was, you know, she's someone we've seen around. She sat in last year on our site recap meeting with Troy. She's not someone that I've had a conversation with, and she is so impressive and so intelligent, and that all comes across. And then hearing her interview with you, that youth comes out, and that I think it wasn't as bad as I thought when they hired her, with people saying, oh, you know, another family member, nepotism, all that. I think people realized her education background and that this wasn't just a hand me job. I think it would surprise people maybe to see a 28-year-old in charge of fan engagement, but that's your demographic. That's what they're going after. The fans that are our age, that are still fans, you can't kill them. They're going to stick around forever. It's this younger group. And just, you know, reading Elizabeth's words is one thing, but hearing her, and like you said, just that excitement and that energy, I think fans are going to be impressed by what they hear in terms of the way she speaks. Now, some of the things she said, there was one quote I wrote down that I think if people were saying this is more of the same, this quote kind of shows that there is a shift. Now, I can't remember. You may have had this in the story too. I can't remember, but she said, I'm going to move as aggressively and quickly as possible. And then we're going to learn and evolve year over year until we're humming. I don't think you're never where you want to be. There's always better. That's kind of Bengals' antithesis from what fans could have expected over the past. I think that's one quote that should excite a lot of Bengals fans. The other one, I've got questions, as you know, you mentioned in the piece, she's not gonna spill the beans about what's coming, but I'm really interested to see how they're gonna ramp up game day. Because she talked about a couple things. It's making it a unique experience, not just to Cincinnati, but game after game. She wants every game to be unique. And so much of the game day experience for a lot of people where they go, she mentions the Chiefs and these other big, like, exciting venues that you go to. It's about tradition. It's about they do this every game. You know, they do this on third down. And so I'm really interested to see, like, what they're going to do that's going to be different from game to game, and then what changes they're going to make that are going to be staples and new traditions at Paul Brown Stadium.
Let's unpack the nepotism word here. You know, yeah. That comes up. It's the immediate first thought, and the idea, this is a massive job. I mean, director of strategy engagement for a company that's valued at $2 billion. There are people who work in that industry, who do that professionally, who their whole lives would never sniff a job like this. It's a huge job. You're in charge of connecting with your consumers. This is kind of a special project side of the business because of the breadth of how much goes on inside of a football team. So yeah, it's a huge job. And, you know, you could pull any 28-year-old off the street, particularly one that's not, you know, that has a different background, and they should come in and be in this job. No, that's not necessarily the true, but football ownership is what it is. And, you know, she is a person who is in line to be at a centerpiece of running this show, a future person running the Bengals. And also, there is a unique ability to get the things done that she has got done. And, you know, how many people, no matter who you were, could come in and win over Mike Brown in conversations about things like this, that Mike has kind of pretty openly, he cares about football. He understands, you know, that element of it. And that's where his focus is. The idea of this side of things, the connecting with fans, social media, game day, that type of stuff is very, he's even called it this. I referenced a story, an interview that Jim Ozarski did when him and I were at the Inquirer together with Mike a couple of years ago. He called fans judgmental and talked about all that stuff is peripheral. Fans come back to winning. And that's true. You're eventually going to have, but how many people could come in and actually move the needle in getting investment in stuff like this? How many? You know, the fact that she's his granddaughter and that where who she is makes her uniquely positioned to actually do this. And like you said, youth is a part of this. And so, yes, like there's no tiptoeing around the obvious of when you bring somebody in who's part of the family, it's family ownership. It's the latest part of the family thing. And that is worth criticism. And there will be that. And, you know, she kind of said, I've got thick skin. You're around it. You understand. And I think that's part of it. But, you know, the other part of it is she's listening and they're trying. And forever, that's all Bengals fans have asked. And understandably, is just show that you're listening to what we care, what we want, what we care about. You know, trying to create some feeling of pride here and actually pulling it off in some respects. And to me, that's where the story comes from, Jay, is really proof that it'd be one thing if she came in and said a lot of things and nothing, and it was just sort of, we're just talking about a person being here saying the right things. We saw the difference that happened in the first year of social media, and that is not all Elizabeth, but they invested in it. They literally created a director of content. They created this director of strategy engagement position. They added people. They restructured and invested in it, and they saw the payoff. They were top five in all the major engagement categories in total and year over year. I mean, immediate payoff. I mean, that is something that does mean something and is a little bit of proof that maybe they're figuring something out and at the very least finding a way to connect with fans and actually get this stuff done.
And it was working. I mean, it was almost immediate. I mean, it was way before the season started, the draft, free agency, the schedule release. They had people talking positively about the Bengals and what they were doing on social media. And maybe that escapes. I don't even know where to put this guess of, you know, what percentage of fans are on social media, but it's growing every day. It's not going to shrink. Let's put it that way. It is growing. And those are the fans you're trying to reach. And just that first step, I think, really kind of excited people to know that they are reaching out to them and trying to engage with them. Nothing's going to replace winning, but showing that you're listening to the fans, the whole Ring of Honor thing that's you know, appears becoming, they haven't made official, all those little steps of just showing that you're listening. And Elizabeth says that's her focus is she wants fans to know that they care about them and that they appreciate them. And that's, I mean, next to winning a Super Bowl, that's what fans want. They want to feel appreciated because for so long in this city, they haven't felt that way. Even in those runs, early in the past decade, those five straight playoff, the team always felt kind of standoff. It felt like there was like this artificial barrier between the fans and the team, and she's working to tear that down.
And you know, you tear it down. You do tear it down by winning playoff games. You do tear it down in that respect, in changing your. But this is part of it. You know, you have a young quarterback who has helped to change your image. You have, you know, what you hope to be this young engagement team. Now that you hope to be part of changing your image. And I think it's a recognition. And we know one thing. You always can tell about how much they care by where they follow the money, right? Like that's almost every business. Follow the money. It's the actual investment in these positions. It's the hiring. It's the adding. It's, you know, these new positions. It's putting time, effort, and energy into it as opposed into other things. And that's part of what fans have asked for. Invest in us, right? Like invest in caring about the fans. And that means things like, you know, they're going to do new uniforms, right? There, you mentioned the Ring of Honor, which appears to be happening. Talk about game day experience. Talk about social media. All this is stuff that they are investing in, and stuff that we at one point wonder if they ever would even care about, despite being asked about it and all of that. And so I think that is part of where there's hope in the connection there. You can't inevitably fix this. And whether it's Seth Tanner or whether it's Elizabeth Blackburn or whether it's Emily Parker or whether it's any of these people that work inside of her, how much does this mean in the big picture? How much can they really change 30 years without a playoff win and the stadium deal and all the other reputation stuff that is just weaved into the core of Bengals fans, right? That is part of this thing that they can't quite reconcile in some ways. All you can do is try. All you can do is try to reconnect with the next generation. I referred to them in an interview with Elizabeth as sort of the Ocho Cinco generation. All those fans that came in with the 03, 04, 05. I mean, changed the image of the Bengals, made the Bengals cool. That was players, right? But, you know, there was also there's a lot of other stuff that can accelerate players making your team cool again, you know? And a lot of those people, you know, don't have a ton of that guilt, Bengal guilt, like Catholic guilt. Like, you know, it's don't have that stuff, that some of that baggage. It exists maybe, but not as much. And you it can make a difference. Inevitably winning is going to be the key, but creating a real sense of what they need is a sense of us and not us versus them. And it does seem like there's always that, like Bengals fans versus the organization thing happening. And maybe this can be a bridge to help eliminate a percentage of that. And I think a recognition of it, investment of it was an important thing to have and show that you care about.
Yeah, I think it's important to note too that it seems easy to say, just let's throw a lot of money at this and let's do this. And there's a tricky line that Elizabeth and Emily and Seth are walking. And that's, you know, this whole thing about branding is fairly new. Elizabeth mentions this, that humility is always going to be a core value of the Bengals. And you can't be completely humble in this day and age. You have to sell yourself. You have to pound your chest. So that's that tricky line that they have to walk. And I think they're doing a great job of it. And if they can start winning on the field, they can go even more in that direction. That's another line right there that it's hard to kind of sell yourself and brag on yourself when you're not winning. So they're off to a good start. Winning on the field certainly will help. And it will be interesting to see, you know, how that line stays straddled, because that is something Mike has always, I mean, you reference it in the interview that the, you know, some people view them as a bad corporate partner or as a bad community partner. And they have donated money and given to causes and done so many things that they never looked to get recognition for. And that's something that has to change now a little bit. You want anything you do that's positive, you want that out there. And so that is going to be something. I don't know if it's going to be a fight between Elizabeth and Mike, but it's definitely, they're coming at it from two totally different perspectives. And it feels like she's winning most of the battles.
Yeah. I mean, at least getting the opportunity to prove it you know, and, yeah. and that's where I think what was the biggest thing about this past year and the positive reaction they've gotten from fans with the whole thing. And obviously social was kind of the way you had to start with what the season was, with what COVID season was. That was the immediate obvious thing to do. And so the success though in that, I think, does hold weight when you then get into trying to do the next thing, which is going to be, okay, now let's try to do the same stuff with game day. And how real is that? You know, that is a much harder task. Mm-hmm. It is a much more difficult thing. Creating community is sort of the biggest thing that they're trying to do here. And how do you do that? I mean, that takes time, and it takes more than a little bit. It takes more than a year. And I want to talk a little bit more about that side of things after you hear from Elizabeth. So we talked for about a half hour. This is about 10 minutes of it, of a few questions. I picked a couple of them that are questions and answers that were not in the story. So you're getting a little bit extra here. We'll talk a little bit about her role. We'll talk a little bit about the whole corporate citizen thing that you mentioned, some of the inspiration from other places, and the fact that she was kind of down in Mobile with the football operations side of things and her talking about that. So anyway, here is about 10 minutes, a little different Q&A from the conversation with Director of Strategy Engagement, Elizabeth Blackburn.
I remember hearing about sort of your return to the Combine last year and how, you know, you were, I don't know how much you were given a specific idea of what your role would be then and how much, or how much it's kind of been figuring all that out and adjusting on the fly as the last year has gone by.
I would say both. Like before I came home, I thought a lot about what my role would and could be, because I wanted to make sure I really felt like I could add value. And thinking about that being where the team was, like, it really all started. The conversation started happening after our Miami game, the end of 2019. And over the course of a few weeks, I landed on, like, literally, I created a job title in a way, which sounds funny to say, but I broke it down as, like, I would focus on strategic projects, reporting and measurement, and data and analytics, because that's very much in my background. And then, like, you'll hear of, you know, strategy and operations. I specifically wanted to think of my role as engagement, because I felt there was this opportunity engaging with fans, engaging with the community, engaging with partners, and engaging with players. And throughout, you know, 2020 and COVID, it some ways played out differently than I expected, but the engagement piece was huge. And I it's been really fun to get to focus on engaging with all the different stakeholders of, you know, Bengals and Houdet Nation in different ways. And that's where the engagement, the content, that was really one of the very first things I was looped in on pre-COVID. And then with kind of how 2020 played out, really focusing on the social media content, engaging our fans through social when people were quarantined, when people were remote, limited capacity in the stadium, that was definitely at the forefront all year. And the content team just did such a great job, like, really taking that huge step forward in that area when the environment really made sense for a lot of reasons.
In the view of, like, sort of the entire rebrand, you know, an argument that I've heard for a long time is that, well, okay, you know, Bengals don't care about their fans and they don't listen to them. And how much did you feel like that was a part of the issue when you attacked sort of the big picture of this project? Or did you view that as maybe a misnomer or something that didn't necessarily exist?
No, I mean, even regardless of what I thought. I want our fans to know how much we care. Like, I personally care so much and love Bengals fans. And so regardless of what I thought or what anybody thought, I'm just purely focused on the upside of, I want all of our fans to feel like we care and we appreciate them.
Yeah. My previous employer used to like to say that the Bengals are not a good corporate citizen. How much was that a part of what you want to wipe out going forward too, as well, is the idea, because you've mentioned, I know, in the stuff that you've written about community and creating community, and that is, and whether right, wrong, or indifferent, a part of that, something that's attached to the Bengals. I mean, how much is that a part of making sure that that feels different going forward too? And that may be in a different realm of a lot of other decisions, but I'm curious from a brand perspective, how much that is on the
Spot on, in that I remember when I came back having conversations with Emily, it's all been in good intention, but the way that the media landscape has changed, and I think even culturally individuals have changed, you know, in the past, several, decades ago past, humility and you didn't need to know about it. It was kind of better if it was kept quiet and you didn't know. For better or for worse, the landscape has shifted. And so while I can say that our organization is always going to remain humble, like that's just a core value, I'm aware that you have to sort of bridge that in a sense of, because I feel like our team, our organization, so many individuals in the organization are incredibly generous and involved in the community. And when I see a discrepancy between perception and reality, I want to find ways to get those two things more aligned.
Last year was so weird. Like, no one's in, it just felt so empty. But I mean, going back to before that, I mean, how much inspiration would you guys kind of derive from other NFL stadiums or even other sports, other, NBA stadiums, whatever? I mean, how much do you, or in other places that you've been to that you particularly, feel like you pull a lot of ideas from that you liked or trying to recreate or model after or anything like that?
Yeah, I think, well, first, we want it to be authentic to the Bengals and to the jungle. But at the same time, we want it to be higher energy. And the couple of sort of aspirations that I have that we talk about pulling in are, I'll give you three concrete examples. And Emily, you're going to laugh, but I can't help but say the one. I'll save it for last. So Seth came from the Chiefs. I actually have not been to a game at Arrowhead, but I have a friend who's a Chiefs fan and seen their games on TV. And obviously they have the record for noise. And there's that. I always think about whether it's an Ohio State game or SEC games. Like, I think college football game day, I love. One of the hardest parts of me deciding to go to Dartmouth College was foregoing a big college football experience and atmosphere. And I've had a couple opportunities to go visit friends at bigger schools during and after college. And it's awesome. And, so those are two football. I really think football has just this unique, larger than life, best sport experience. So the third one that's not football, it's not another sport, is a Taylor Swift concert, which I've never even been to, but I'm just like,
I've been to more Taylor Swift concerts than you, Elizabeth. Really? Absolutely.
So I had a manager when I was at Bain who, she was like 42 years old, and every time a Taylor Swift tour was starting, she would talk about it nonstop and couldn't wait for the tickets to drop. And I've I watched like the Netflix movie or whatever, like documenting her tour. And it's not so much the lights and the glitz, but it's the passion from all of her fans who are there. And like, she does such an amazing job making every show feel different and give every fan, whether it's your first or your 100th show, it's special and unique. And, you know, I want like every person ever to want to come to every Bengals game here at Paul Brown Stadium, because it's an amazing experience and you know you're getting something sort of different every time.
I know you were down in I know you're down in Mobile and you've been involved with some of the football side of things. How's kind of your role there on that side of things going, and what's that look like, you know, kind of going forward?
So I'm learning and I'm like trying to offer some like value add or assistance in terms of data and analytics. Mm-hmm. Like I work with Sam and Tyler and our scouts and love pulling data. So I sort of just try to add value how I can in that regard, and then just familiarize myself with some of the football processes. It's been like one amazing to get the exposure and start learning, but it's the most important part of the business. So
yeah,
it's important that, you know, I stay close to it and understand it, but I really, besides sort of some light football analytics and process, like in consulting, process optimization is sort of a thing that I like doing. So, but really the majority of my time has been more on kind of the, engagement front.
All right, let's take a second and switch gears here and hear from a sponsor. Before I get into game day stuff, people, you know, one of the things that caught my eye and made me do a double take, you know, the Bengals were only allowed to have 10 people down in Mobile, and one of them was Elizabeth Blackburn. She ended up going, and it was one of those things that made you say, what? What did, you know, you can only have so many scouts and coaches down there, and one of them's going to be the director of strategy and engagement. And she pointed out she's kind of coming at it. She was basically there as a representation of ownership, to kind of basically report back some of the football side of things, and that she's kind of learning, I guess, on that side. I mean, she's in on all these meetings. You know, she's in with the football side of stuff, kind of learn, you know, you know, background analytics doesn't hurt anybody.
No.
And they can always use more of that. She mentioned, I think she mentioned Sam in there. You might say, who's Sam Francis is kind of the head of their analytics realm. Does a lot for them. And so, okay. You know, but that she admitted herself. I mean, look, that's not who I'm trying to be right now. I'm kind of focused on that, but there is a bridge to all of that between the team and what they're trying to sell and all that stuff too. That's part of it. So she's there as part of that. Game day, you know, so as I mentioned before this, you know, fans, you know, it's easy to say, let's make this be like Kansas City. Well, they were setting decibel level records a long time ago. There's a certain, it is that sense of community and passion. It's easy to say, I want people to be excited about buying tickets for this, like a Taylor Swift concert. Like, that's easy to say. And shout out for the Taylor Swift reference. You know, look, as somebody who has two daughters and a wife who's obsessed with Taylor Swift, I have an appreciation, very much an appreciation for her. I've even been to a concert, as I did for a birthday gift for my wife a couple years ago. I have a lot of respect for the insane, passionate community that exists that follows Taylor Swift. And I totally understand that reference. I hope people who are hardcore football people weren't like, the new person wants Taylor Swift to be an inspiration. I want to go to a football game. I hope that's not. I hope people understand, like, Taylor Swift has a passionate global community that sops up every single new song she writes and has cultivated that in some super strategic ways that have made everybody in the entertainment industry follow her lead. I'm not here to, you know, I'm obviously standing on the Taylor Swift soapbox here a little bit, but I'm just saying, I hope people understand that analogy is about passion. But that is not, you know, Taylor Swift was strumming guitars at the Grand Ole Opry. She didn't have that. You know, that takes a long time to build. And, you know, I think that is the thing, that element of this community, the passion, the people wanting more and every day feels like it, this intense, different experience that is only brought on by winning in a big way. And you do that once, and I think it happens. Now, you need this other stuff in place to accentuate that and help with taking those wins and turning them into, you know, hitting the exponential multiplier on that impact, making the most out of it, catching lightning in a bottle, as Seth likes to say. And giving it to everybody, you know, and that's part of it. But really, to really create that, look, that's on Joe Burrow, right?
Yes. And it's, you know, it feels like we're far enough away from those five straight playoff appearances earlier last decade that there's been a reset where, you know, during that time, it was viewed as a failure. If you go to the playoffs again and lose in the first round, it's like, oh, another. It's been so bad lately, and now 5 years without being in the playoffs, that it feels like if like you mentioned, building that excitement, if they were to make the playoffs and lose in the first round, I there would be a segment of the population where here we go again. But I think overall, it would be seen as a step forward. Like, okay, here we go. We got there with Joe Burrow. Now – build on it. Next year is the year when it really takes off. And so I think establishing that passion is more on the shoulders of the coaches and the players in the winning. What I really liked about her analogy, as someone who goes to a lot of concerts, but what I really liked about her Taylor Swift analogy was the idea of making every concert different, making every game different, making people feel like they're at a special event, not just one of eight or one of 10, if you include preseason. You know, one of my, it's like a love hate thing that I do when I go to concerts is I always, there's, you can go online and look up the set list. And most bands, it's the same night after. So we plan our bathroom breaks. We plan our beer buying around which songs we don't care if we hear or not, because you know when they're coming. And I hate it when bands mix it up and don't follow a set list, but I love it at the same time, because I think it's great that a band doesn't just go out there and go through the motions and they try to bring something different every concert. And that's, she talks about that in your interview, that's really a goal. And I think that's hard. I think it's a lot easier to do in a concert than it is a football game. Even though there's fewer football games to do it. But I think that is going to be one of the bigger challenges. And as I mentioned before, it's one of the things I'm most interested to see what the game day experience is going to look like, is how they're going to differentiate it and make each game feel like its own event and not just one of eight.
One way from the conversation with Seth that I took away was him talking about, well, how social media is a conversation, right? And you know, you're in that trend of that week, whatever that is, you're weighing in, you're doing a Bengals element to it. It's not just, here's a video about a guy, it's interacting with whatever's going on. And we've sort of seen that, right? I mean, we've seen that be a very much a staple of their last year on social media. And that was a big part of their success, was whatever was being said or whatever was the thing that week. They're in the middle of it from a Bengals perspective. And this is, you know, on par with what most teams do, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, they took it from this area that was just sort of kind of a, for a little bit of, I don't want to call it a forgotten corner, but really a kind of a forgotten corner, and brought it into being on par with what teams do and doing it pretty well. I think you can do the same thing with game day through the same lines. And that is, he mentioned game day in the same way as a conversation. And he said a game in Kansas City, it must have been talking about something with Colin Cowherd had taken on Chiefs fans for not being able to handle the cold weather, or took a shot at Chiefs fans. And right before the game, they played this clip right at the prime time for everyone in the stadium to hear. And he said it never had been louder that game. It just did this thing. It just created this juice. And those are the moments that you, that are unique to that moment in time. Whatever you've got going on, whether it's getting ripped by Colin Cowherd as a unifying thing, or whether it's, you know, a player who's having an incredible season or run that can be a part of that, that can make it feel different or unique, or bringing back a guy who's getting honored in the Ring of Honor and having that be a part of thing. We talk, look, this is stuff that happens everywhere. You know, I go back to Seattle, right? Raising the 12. Right? The who's going to be there to raise the flag. You remember that? That was unique to that day. That was the day that Paul Rudd raised the 12, you know, or whatever it is. Like, there, you know, there's these things across. Who banged the drum? Steph Curry banged the drum before the Super Bowl, right? Like, Carolina, you know, keep pounding. This stuff exists everywhere. And that is the kind, and we see this, you know, Jay, you and I, when we travel, we're at all these games, we see these atmospheres and we see what's created. And it can be, you know, passion is in so many ways. Seattle is unique for a reason. Kansas City is unique for a reason. It's because of the people. It's because of the energy that they bring, because they have that ingrained in them. You know, that has not always been a thing here in Cincinnati. In fact, it's usually been the opposite, has been what's been more noted. But those are the types of things that you can do to make everything feel different, feel unique, you know, and can be accentuated by things like, you know, whether it's the Ring of Honor stuff or new traditions. And that's a big part of college, which she mentioned as well as an inspiration. The traditions of college football, right? I mean, stuff that happens that just gets people juiced up at games. Being more than just the game. And selling the rest of it as an entertainment experience, you know, something it's harder to do. It's different to do in football than in other sports. And it's particularly notable when you lack in it, when you do have a team down the road that is exceptional at that, at making the atmosphere around the game be more important than even the game itself, and have this connection with community. No one has done that better than the Reds through all the avenues that we've just talked about here during this, whether it's social, whether it's game day, whether it's new stuff in the stadium, whether it's baseball. It's easier to do. It's 81 games to park. You know, it's harder to do in football, but, you know, it certainly can be done, and they certainly can reach levels like that.
Could we see a have a toss on the field after a Bengals game, like you see with the Reds? They do that on Father's Day, where you can go out and throw. I mean, I don't know, it'll still be COVID era. You can't do that kind of thing. But though you're right, those are the kind of things that you can do to make each game different. I always think back, like, something you would think it would be more of a juice element, I guess is the way to put it. It's very sterile, like most things at Paul Brown Stadium when they announce the starting lineups. And I remember there was one game that we were at in Baltimore, and all they did before they started announcing the players was show Ray Lewis up in a box waving a flag, and that place went berserk, and it just never stopped after that. That's the fans were fired up for the player announcements, and you hear them in Cincinnati, and it's like, I mean, yes, we're in a press box, and it's a little sealed off. You don't hear the total fan reaction, but it just feels like almost like a smattering of polite golf applause sometimes when they announce some of those players. And as you were talking there, I was like, I think that's one thing we can count on, is there's going to be, they've already leaned on it some, the Von Bell hit on Juju Smith-Schuster. Even if Juju's not in Pittsburgh next year, I think that's going to be something that they're going to lean on again next year when the Steelers come to Cincinnati, and you can pretty much guarantee that the defense will be the unit announced before that game. And maybe that is something that you see that pick up, where Von Bell's, he was new last year. There weren't a lot of fans in the crowd anyhow. But I think that's something where you could see them really kind of like, not just focus on the player that is being inducted in the Ring of Honor that week, if that's the way they go, but kind of highlighting players ahead of a game and playing into a pounding of the drum kind of thing, or any of that element where it just starts early. It starts with the player introductions and gets the crowd jacked, and then you hope the play on the field keeps it going.
Seth mentioned it's going to be fun to see how much pyro I can get. I know, Jay, you can appreciate that. I know, yes. You can appreciate that. If the pyro is expensive, but you know, you do get into elements of that, of making, that's the type of stuff that makes it feel big. And you know, you see these Monday Night Football games, the overhead shot of fireworks firing off all around the top of stadiums, and you know, that's the type of stuff that makes it feel huge. And I think that's part of what they want it to be. They want it to feel huge and feel like something that people really need to be done. Can they pull it off? I don't know. I don't know. We shall see. And I think that's kind of a part of this is, you know, they're going to try, and they're trying because they've heard fans complaining about all of this stuff and understand that's a big part of how they can reconnect. So yeah. I hope people enjoyed that conversation with Elizabeth, and you know, they'll obviously have plenty more that they're going to be rolling out over the course of the off season with that, and they're kind of putting her out there now. Like, she was here for a year, and I'm, you know, behind the scenes, I mean, I've been trying to write about social media for a long time. I'm trying to talk about it to Elizabeth really since, well, for a year now, pretty much since she came back. But they kind of wanted her to start slow, do her own thing before you start, you know, putting somebody like that out there. Like we said, her name, you know, it is a story. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like with the season now behind and they had some success in the area where she was kind of focused, they're able to put her in. She, you know, she wrote her thing last week, her vision. Up on Bengals.com, and you know, Jeff Hobson did sort of a background profile on who she is for those that don't know. So they, you know, they kind of, you know, are ready to kind of put this whole element of what they're trying to do forward facing and really go for it. And so you'll see plenty more of her and talk about all this type of stuff as the off season unfolds.
Yeah, and the game day thing you mentioned, I think it's important to note that it's not just the Bengals fighting themselves or fighting their past. They've got an uphill climb. You're talking about a COVID era. You're talking about, you know, not just the virus itself, but people hurting financially. I mean, they may have a lot of fans that want to come to games, and it just may not be feasible. And then there's that, the whole element too of, I think that every football team has to deal with this is it's not quite as family friendly as baseball. I mean, there's a lot of people that go down and start drinking 3 hours before the game. And it is, I took my son to games when he was single to 8, 9, 10 years old. And I told him, you're going to hear some things. I don't care if you hear them, you can't say them. And it's, we saw people with puke on themselves. We saw people fighting. We saw people just being idiot jerks, drunk. It's that is a, there, all those things are tough to battle on top of trying to like break out of their own history. So it's, they definitely have their work cut out for them. And as much as we're interested in seeing what the team does on the field, equally as interested after reading your piece about how they're gonna navigate this whole thing this season with fans and engagement and just the whole ball of wax.
Yeah, I don't know if you can ever really sell football as being for young fans, like kids. You know, once you're a certain age, you know, you get to be a teenager or whatever, like, okay, you can handle football, whatever. But I tell people, take your little kids to preseason game number 4.
Yeah.
It's cool. Like, there's none of that stuff that would keep you away, that would make you nervous, that exists because of the juices of the competitiveness and the intensity of the other games. Preseason game number 4, it's low key. You're still looking. There's all the players on the field and all the things that you want your kids to see. They can see the players, even the good players that aren't playing or standing there on the sidelines. Take your young kid to preseason game number 4, but you know, it's an adult experience in the regular season. And I think it would be a mistake to ever try to sell the like family atmosphere of football. Like, it's just not what that sport is. You know what I mean? It's the gladiator arena.
That's why they do family day during training camp. Yeah. That is a great chance for fans to bring their kids down. And they do a really good job of that. If any of you, I know it got whacked last year, but if any of you guys listening have young kids, that is, practice isn't the most interesting thing in the world, but they have enough stuff going on around the practice that it'll hold your kids' attention. And that is a great way, in addition to preseason game four, to kind of introduce your kids to football.
Absolutely. I certainly hope that we are doing those types of things in the fall. Yes. All right, let's shift gears here, and we'll get back into the on-field side of some things. As far as some news that's going on, you know, the big news yesterday was J.J. Watt announcing himself to the Cardinals. You know, he also does not have a Peloton bike.
Was that coincidence, or do you think
just ridiculous, whatever was going on. I mean, this time of year. It's exhausting. The speculation and this and that. It's just, we're so close. I'm ready to just get there and we can just be done with this part of it. And then we can start the speculation about draft stuff, which is fun. But this is such a huge piece and it's just been hanging out there forever. I think everybody's kind of ready for that part of the offseason to just happen. And some of it's happening. Here's the interesting thing. So J.J. Watt gets, you know, it's our first look, just real look at a big contract in this year. And we're all kind of wondering, what are these going to look like, right? I mean, we don't know how owners and teams are approaching with the uncertainty of finances and the cap. And now we've got this TV deals look like they're going to start rolling in. And is that going to take the cap number way up? And the 17th game is looking like it's going to happen, which, by the way, looks, according to Peter King, who had kind of the reports on where that's at, looks like AFC would host this year, yeah, according to him. So that would be Bengals hosting the 49ers, hoping that goes differently than it did 2 years ago when they lost 41-13, I believe. And another nice opponent on that home slate, which is pretty serious next year. So you've got like all this stuff of what will these look like? And that, so you get into Carl Lawson and William Jackson of, well, what are their contracts going to look like? Well, you can kind of do some correlation between J.J. Watt and Carl Lawson as far as top of the line, defensive linemen. You know, 2 years and about fifth at 31, 23 guaranteed, I mean, is a pretty good deal. We talked about the franchise tag for Lawson would be looking to be probably about 16. Would you rather have Carl Lawson or J.J. Watt?
Carl Lawson.
You'd rather have Carl Lawson.
I was stunned by the J.J. Watt contract.
Yeah.
I don't care how win now minded you are. Given a guy that age with that injury history, 23 guaranteed, I know you got to do it if you want him. You got to win that bidding war. But, man, that feels like way more risk than maybe a team like that, a team with a fairly young offensive core would want to take on. There are, you could get 2-3 edge rushers for that same money and have a nice rotation there. And I love everything about J.J. Watt, the way he plays, what he's meant to Houston, but man, that really surprised me, that contract. Maybe if Bengal fans ask them, would you have given him $23 million? I would say most would say no, not at this stage of his career.
I don't know, because I mean, if we're just talking about 1 year, if we're talking about 1 year of Carl Lawson versus 1 year, I mean, again, this is just talking about nothing because J.J. Watt's going to Arizona. But I mean, if you're talking about 1 year, you know, J.J. Watt, I think if you look at pass rush win rate, was actually higher than Carl Lawson last year. He's better against the run. He's three down guy. He's more versatile than Carl Lawson. Carl Lawson is a pass rush down pass rush specialist. He's fine against the run. He's okay. But he's not going to be a force, and he's not versatile. And now, how important are those things to you? I don't know, but I mean, if you care about pass rush win rate, JJ Watt was actually better than Carl Lawson was last year. And you saw more double teams. There's that graph, I believe, that Seth Walder from ESPN Deep Analytics had, and we're getting into the, you know, a lot of minutia there. Yeah. I always get nervous about signing guys to big contracts who are post 30 in almost every circumstance. And, you know, that's been no more notable than here, where it has kind of drowned them in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, I'm with you. And Carl Lawson is not that. He is in his prime, and your expectations would be perhaps even more ascension, more so than even, you know, stability to do what he did last year. I think it's close, and I think there's value to the versatility and the every downness, because here's the thing: you can get for cheaper rotational pass rush down pass rush specialists to go along, but finding the every down guy is part of the hard part.
Yeah, and I guess part of it comes down to, you know, you said who would you rather have? There's so many variables that go into it. Are you saying who would I rather have in 2021? Yeah, maybe it is J.J. Watt as opposed to Carl Lawson. But if you're saying, who would you rather have, J.J. Watt for 2 years at all that huge money, or Carl Lawson at three or four for, you know, a considerable less amount? Yeah, I would rather have the younger guy on a longer, cheaper contract than not just the and this goes to Carl too, but it's not just the age with J.J. Watt, but it is that injury history too. You always worry about that. And you know, Carl's had that as well, but he is younger. That kind of offsets that a little bit. I don't know. It's a tough question. The $23 million just really surprised me. I knew J.J. Watt was going to have a lot of suitors and get a big contract, but 23 guaranteed just seemed like a reach for Arizona.
I think it also suggests that Carl might still get pretty good coin.
Yes.
And, you know, and maybe make it more obvious that they're going to have to tag him if they can't get the long term done later in the year, because if teams are going to be willing, if teams are willing to go up into the fifth, you know, into that range for JJ Watt, how close will they go for Carl Lawson if they're looking for edge rush help? I guess we'll either find out or we won't, depending on if we see the tag officially applied on March 9th or whenever before the deadline that is. All right, let's just take a quick break. You had some stats, didn't you?
Yeah, I do, on J.J. Watt. I was thinking, because everybody thinks back to that first, Andy's rookie year, that playoff game when he batted the pass and intercepted it and returned it for a touchdown. And there's this, I don't know if it's a fallacy. I guess these stats might suggest it is that J.J. Watt has been this Bengals wrecker. I looked it up. Where does he? How many career sacks does he have against the Bengals? And where does that rank amongst players who have the most career sacks against the Bengals? J.J. Watt is tied for 313th. He has one career sack against the Bengals. Now he has two in the playoffs, so he has three total. So if you include playoff games, he's tied for 99th among players that have sacked the Bengals.
I'm guessing Bengals fans will include playoff games.
Yes. But it was interesting because, I mean, I also looked, he's played five career games against the Bengals. So it's not, you look at some of these guys that have the most career sacks against the Bengals, most of them played in the division with the Bengals. Obviously, you're getting two games a year against them every year. But among players with five or fewer regular season games against the Bengals, J.J. Watt ranks 156th with that one little sack. So I think Bengal fans are happy he's not in the division. There's some worry he might join up with his brother in Pittsburgh, or he might go to Cleveland. But I don't think it's the big exhale of relief that maybe some people thought it was. I do have some trivia off of these stats. Do you know what player has the most sacks against the Bengals all time? Well, since 82, when it was official stat.
Most sacks against the Bengals. Yeah. Well, I mean, I would think I'd assume it'd be somebody in the division.
Yep.
Yeah. So
recently retired when in played more in the passing era.
Terrell Suggs.
Yep. 12 and a half.
Yeah.
And then Jason Gilden, 12, Greg Lloyd, 11. Those are the top. The sack leader among active players. This one shouldn't be too hard.
Amongst all active players?
Yes.
I don't know. Myles Garrett?
No, he's got 5 in 5 games, so he's on a heck of a pace.
Let's see. It's not TJ Watt.
It is TJ Watt.
It is TJ Watt?
7.5.
Wow. Is the active number, huh?
Yes. Right. And Von Miller right behind him at 6.5. And then, as I mentioned, one more trivia for you off these stats. All these players, the top 17 are all guys that played in the Bengals division at some point. Who do you think the sack leader against the Bengals is for somebody that never played in the division with them?
Well, you just said Von Miller, right? All time?
No. Von Miller's active. Yeah, this is a guy that he's no longer playing. He's recently retired, last 4 or 5 years.
Oh, geez, Jay.
Yeah, it's tough. when you hear it, you'll be like, oh, yeah. Dwight Freeney.
Okay.
Yeah. He had 7.5 as well, tied with TJ Watt, but TJ's active. So Dwight Freeney, Von Miller, Mike Bell, who played for the Chiefs. Those are the guys that never were in the Bengals division that have the most sacks against him.
Jay goes deep. Deep stats. A little bit on some of the latest round of cap casualties that showed up. A lot of these will be guys that you've heard us talk about in the past. We did the whole cap casualty show essentially a week or two ago. That list of, it was every team's writer, all our insiders looking at who they thought the cap casualties could be for each team. And so some of these would make sense. I think most of these were on the list, actually. Any of this round that have kind of stood out to you, Jay?
Yeah, we talked about it on that show, Jarrell Casey. I mean, it's just a great fit. They've already pulled the trigger. The Bengals, I mean, there's guys that everybody assumes the Bengals are going to cut. They have not announced any of these yet. Other teams have gone ahead and informed players they're releasing them. So Jarrell Casey is a big one. Not sure they'll be able to get that done if they're signing guys in free agency on the offensive line. The issue there is Jarrell Casey is a vested veteran who's been terminated. He can sign. He doesn't have to wait till March 17th. So I think a team like the Bengals, who really wants to kind of set that offensive line first, Jarrell Casey may be off the board before they start moving forward with their plan. Another one, I got a question about Nick Martin, center for the Texans, can play center and guard. He was released. Again, that's a situation where we talked last week about DJ Reader and knowing J.J. Watt really well, you would assume he would know Nick Martin. People ask if he would be a fit just because of that versatility and because of the needs they have. But it almost feels like he's the same as what they have. He's not necessarily going to be an upgrade. Last year was the worst year that he's had, based on Pro Football Focus grades. It just feels like he's going to be another one of those guys that, a Trey Hopkins, a Quentin Spain, someone that can play both positions, but maybe not necessarily excel at either one. I don't see him being a real target among these cap casualties.
This is always something that you can look at when one of these moves happens. And that was, as soon as it happened, I happened to go into the comments to the store, to the tweet from Adam Schefter, and it was nothing but rejoicing Texans fans. Oh, finally, yeah. We did something right. Reminded me of like when the Bengals let go of Russell Bodine. It's like, okay, you can always kind of tell by with fans who are kind of sick of watching what they've been watching. And if you, I'm not saying Nick Martin won't be good or that the fans aren't wrong. I'm just saying you do tend to get a feeling for those that have been watching him closely, what they think about that guy. And maybe he will now become your problem that you can't wait for them to let go of, like it seemed to be with the Texans. I think I'm with you. The Casey thing is interesting. You know, how much does he have left? You know, when he signed last year, he still was pretty productive. The injury, you know, where is he falling off the shelf? Are we talking about him the same way again? We're post a 30-plus-year-old defensive lineman. Yeah, he had some juice a few years ago. How much does he still have? You know, I think you think there will be some, but the question is, does his value come down because people are scared of wondering how much he actually has left? And if he becomes a second wave guy, then he becomes really interesting for the Bengals. And I think somebody you could see as part of a bigger picture fix. I don't see them going up into where the level he was making, you know, that he got last year was about 11 mil per year. Yeah. I wouldn't see them going into that range. But if the league is scared off by the injury, scared off by the fact that he's older, 1 year older, and Denver just opted to just let him go, any of that stuff. And his, you know, and he falls through the cracks. He has Von Bell to him, you know, last year fell through the cracks. A guy maybe people assumed would be in the first wave, surprised to still see there. And you get him at a pretty good pricing and come in and really be impactful for you on a short term, on a 2 year deal. That's where he makes sense to me, where the Bengals would maybe land him. I wouldn't see him being a target, a first wave type target or somebody they'd go after right now. And I don't think any team would go after Casey right now. I think a lot of teams are going to bundle a lot of these guys, going to wait and see how free agency shakes out at the beginning. Watt is different. He's a frontline guy, you know, but Casey would not fit in that mix. Some of the other names just showed up, maybe DeSean Jackson, Tyrell Williams, AJ Bouye was let go by Denver. Maybe he could be somebody once they get into the corner market, you know, and they're, if William Jackson leaves and if they're still looking to find somebody, he could be a name that shows up. But none of the other, Alex Smith let go by Washington. You say, okay, backup quarterback with some, you know, good leader, could play behind Burrow, be there in case you need him. I don't see that happening. I think he's, everybody's kind of pointing to Jacksonville. You know, you're going to have Trevor Lawrence coming in, Urban Meyer, who was with Alex Smith. There's a history there. Could use a veteran with the young guy. I think there's a lot of to the stuff to that. And there's a lot of teams that still need starting quarterbacks out there.
Right.
That Alex Smith could land with. You know, Alex Smith's not going to be interested in being Joe Burrow's backup if he could go play for the Bears, you know, and maybe start. So you've got a few other options there that are on the table. So I wouldn't see that happening.
One name that this isn't a cap casualty, but Shiel Kapadia has out his list of the top free agents on the defensive line. He, the offensive line was yesterday. So both of these pieces, I think Bengals fans will get something out of reading because it shows you who's out there. And this one really surprised me. Like, if I ask who was second in the league in sacks last year, I bet 90% of the people wouldn't know the answer. And it was Trey Hendrickson from the Saints.
Yeah.
He had 13.5, just kind of a quiet, unsung guy, only 26, heading into free agency. And, you know, Cat Terrell has written about how strapped they are for cash down there. And he's not a guy that he hasn't had 4 years of that kind of production. It was a one hit wonder kind of thing. So it's going to be really interesting to see what he commands in free agency, if he's going to be one of those guys that breaks the bank, or if he's going to be a guy that may slide into that second realm that you can maybe get on a bargain. That was a name that kind of stood out to me when I read Shields' piece today on the D-line free agents.
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be a bunch of guys out there. I still, you know, it's hard to tell, you know, you never know exactly where the plan will focus or how it will unfold. I think D-line is going to be in the mix, but again, we're so speculative at this point.
Silly season, Marvin called it.
Yeah, it is. You know, the one thing I want to mention was something that I posted or I retweeted and that was, it was a graph. It was over the cap, had it, and it took winning percentage the last 4 years on a graph along with free agent spending, total free agent spending. And it created a fairly definitive line diagonally where those that spent the least won the most, and those that spent the most won the least. The Bengals were like, on those graphs, you just never want to be alone. It was the Bengals were sort of down in this bottom left where they spent the least and won the least. And I sort of termed it when doing it right goes wrong. And, you know, they've been trying to do it right and kind of follow that lead of those teams in the top left of that graph, which was, you know, the teams that you might imagine, and Pittsburgh and Baltimore up amongst those in a big group. But you find yourself in a rare situation when you don't spend and when you have the types of extension whiffs and first round pick whiffs that the Bengals have had. That's where you find yourself in that didn't spend a lot on free agents and didn't win, because you're not spending a lot of free agents typically because your roster is already pretty solid and you don't need to go elsewhere to fill holes. You don't want to have to do that. So that's a lot of where that graph comes from, but you know, that's a reminder. And there's just top right teams that spent a ton on free agents and won. It's the Bills. There's like one team up there. It can happen that way, but the vast majority of the great teams, the sustainable models, are using free agency as a complementary piece, and everything goes as through the drafts and draft, develop, and retain, which has been a Bengals model. They just haven't drafted well. And really, so many of these teams, that's the bottom line story of the last 4 years. Did you draft well? Yes. Then you were probably pretty good. If you whiffed, you probably weren't. Free agent spending, you know, you have to spend more on free agent to make up for the fact that you didn't draft well. That is in so many ways what this league comes down to. And we make a big deal out of free agency, and rightfully so. We've seen some teams succeed at that. But it really does come down to getting the most value out of your draft picks. That's really so much of what it is and why the Bengals are where they are right now, because they had a string of bad drafts that just ate at them.
I wish there was a way to do one of those charts, those four quadrant charts where you don't want to be in the lower left. I remember AJ Green was all by himself in the lower left of the production and separation one that they put out a while ago. I wish there was a way to kind of correlate dollars spent in free agency versus production received, not just winning percentage, but, you know, because the Bengal Duke talks about this all the time, that the guys that you overpay for in free agency rarely end up being worth it. And it's hitting on that second and third wave. That's where you make your inroads. It would be almost impossible to do, because it's hard to measure. Every position is so different. It's hard to, you know, kind of come up with a standard quantification of production.
But you'd probably have to end up at PFF and using your grades. I mean, that would be where you would do it. And I'm sure they have. I'm guessing it's somewhere in one of their, pages and pages and pages and pages of models and grading and things like that. All right. I think that's about covers it. I hope everybody enjoyed it. We'll be back next week, as we will be a little bit closer. Expectations are we are going to be hearing from Duke Tobin and Zach Taylor next week as sort of part of their combine interviews without the combine. So we'll have some of that. And franchise tag deadline is next Wednesday, the 9th. So we'll be coming up on that. We may even have information on that. So
it's a week from today, Tuesday.
Next Tuesday. What is today? Yes. The second? I don't know what day it is anymore, Jay. It's been a long few days. Long year. So, yeah, a week from today, we will have the franchise tag deadline. We'll be talking to Duke and Zach and free agency will be right around the corner. Cap cuts are going to be flying. Probably new year stuff's right around the corner. So, starting to get even more interesting, and we'll have all that for you next week. And of course, you know, any emergency podcast that can occur could still occur. You never know this time of year when something comes out of nowhere. So, all right, thanks everybody for listening, and we will talk to you next week on Podcast Ground. Have a good one, everybody.